lost the first part of it, in which case that would be unfortunate, or if this thing automatically saves when it did whatever it did, which is probably to briefly disconnect the battery. Anyway, as I was saying, I should probably get back to the stuff that's in our reading, but technological protection is something that I've been intrigued by for a couple of decades now and wrote about quite a long time ago, and so I wanted to talk about it a bit. So next question is, how does technological protection interface with copyright law? And one of the versions of this question, and one which I've also written about quite a long while ago, is, does it violate fair use? All right, let us suppose that I am distributing my intellectual property and somehow I've solved the analog hole problem. It's the kind of thing that the analog hole doesn't apply to, whatever. And I distribute it in some way that doesn't let you make your parody of it. Is that a violation of fair use? Yeah? Can it be?
Like, let's say it's like, I know there was one case where a mom recorded a baby dancing to some song, and then I guess the record company tried to take it down.
But they're not using technological protection to protect their song. I'm not asking the question of whether they can sue anybody. That is part of what's interesting about technological protection is that it's in some sense an alternative to copyright, right? Just like a locked safe is an alternative to arresting thieves. You can do both of them, of course, but there are different ways of protecting your property. One way of protecting your property is to say, well, look, it's sitting right out there in the open, but if you steal it, I'll call the cops. A different way is, no cops around, I don't care, this safe, there's no way you can get into it. So suppose, for example, let me take the very simplest form of technological protection, which almost is workable and which is a real case. I have a nutty religion, let's call it Scientology, and I have a revenue plan. And my revenue plan is that I tell people that my religion will make you into a Superman. But it takes a while, and you've got to study these special texts we've got. And because we don't want the hoi polloi to know about our secrets, these texts are in books chained to the desk in our own reading room, and we charge you to go into that reading room. This is, in fact, part of the business plan of the Church of Scientology. And suppose that you spend some money doing this, and you eventually decide it's a fraud, and you'd like to debunk it. And it's much easier to debunk it if you can actually quote from these texts. But they're chained to a desk somewhere. And when you go to the Church of Scientology and say, look, fair use says that I'm allowed to do criticism, so would you mind letting me into your reading room so that I can photocopy your texts, so that I can quote appropriate chunks of them, and they say no, are they doing anything that fair use forbids them from doing? I don't think so. Yeah?
Fair use is just a defense to infringement.
That's the point. If you go, I think you can find on my webpage, I think I've got webbed an exchange I had with, I think, Julie Cohen on this a long, long time ago. And that was the argument I was making, at least, is that fair use is a defense to infringement. It isn't a right. That is, and the obvious case, I wasn't thinking of Church of Scientology, and that's a particularly striking one. But suppose what you want to parody is a book I haven't published yet. You don't have a right to get into my house and read stuff on my computer just because you have a right to write parodies. And similarly, you can think of lots of other cases of that sort. So then the question is, does technological protection follow that pattern? If I can somehow make it physically impossible via some kind of digital things rather than via a lock on my door for you to do the parodying you want to do, does that violate fair use? And I think the answer is that it doesn't. Now, there are two cases where it gets more complicated, though. One of them is, suppose the only reason I'm able to make my protection work is the DMCA. Suppose what I've done is, I've distributed my movie in a cryptolope, and I don't know why you can't photograph the screen, but for some reason it isn't practical to do that, you could use software to get it out of the cryptoloper to record it. But I'll have you arrested if you do that, because that software is violating the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Now can we say, I'm now using state action in order to prevent you from parodying me, and DMCA does say it's a copyright act. Whether it really is not entirely clear to me, but it's an act, at least we're protecting copyrights. So now can we argue that when I try to have you arrested for cracking the software that was protecting my movie that you wanted to do a spoof of, your defense is, sorry, buddy, that was fair use, and copyright law doesn't apply to fair use. Is that a defensible argument, people think? Yes, no, any opinions? Yeah?
The Ticketmaster case dealt something with that.
Tell us about it.
The Ticketmaster case was a guy made software that would go into the Ticketmaster website and it would make copies on the RAM. So the digital copies of the RAM were then violating the Ticketmaster.com copyright. So the...
What was he doing digital copies of the RAM for?
Well, just whenever you load the page, it automatically makes the digital copies on the RAM.
I see. Yep.
So they were saying you made the copy that was fixed in the handle medium, therefore you violated the copyright. Just by going onto our page with this special program that our terms of use, they had a little terms of use thing we had to agree to. And because the terms of use said you can't go on with a program like this,
yes,
and you went on with a program like this, you then violated our copyright act.
Yes, I think this is in a way getting to a different issue I was going to discuss, which is another one, which is the combination of all of this with contract.
Mm-hmm.
Because presumably the terms of use they were claiming were a contract, weren't they, or not?
They did that, and then the DMCA came up in that context because the program would get around the little CAPTCHA. So it would get around that, and that actually violated the DMCA.
Right.
But ultimately, I don't remember what point I was coming up with.
What were the results of the case?
They claimed fair use and didn't work.
Didn't work. Yeah. Yeah, because it does seem to me that my example of the locked door case suggests why fair use might not be applicable. But then if you think about the cases where you're somehow combining the technology with law in various ways, it now becomes a little bit less clear whether it's applicable or not. No, does that make sense? Maybe it doesn't. Anyway. Let me go on to a couple of other things. First, let's talk a little bit about Tom Bell's piece, because Tom Bell is pro-technological protection, basically, and it's nice to have somebody on that side of the argument, too. So could somebody describe what his view is about why customers should be happy that people producing intellectual property have various ways of controlling its sale and its distribution and use and such? Anybody? Nobody? All right. That his argument basically is that a lot of the cost of getting information is transaction cost. That if you can make digital information available online and charge for its use, that makes it possible to greatly lower the transaction cost of getting at it. The sensible price to charge for its use usually isn't very high, given there are a lot of other people out there with digital stuff that they're willing to sell, and that therefore the net effect is of replacing fair use, in effect, with market transactions made possible by some sorts of protection, is first that it's easier to get at stuff because the people are not trying to keep it from you but to give it to you, so to speak. Second, that you avoid all the legal uncertainty about fair use, because since fair use is such a fuzzy concept, you've got to worry that if the way I made my pastiche of six different movies was that I claimed it was fair use, I spent a lot of effort making it, and then you win the copyright suit and I can't distribute it. Whereas if the way I made it was to pay $3 to him and $2 to him and $4 to him. Now I got permission to use it. And it's easy. And then his final argument is that anything that makes it easier for the producers of intellectual property to make money out of it is going to tend to drive down the cost because they're competing with each other. And anytime it's profitable to do something, other people come in and do it and drive down the price. So that was, I thought, an interesting different perspective of it. Let me go back. Let me go on to the Lippmann article, which intrigued me in part because it's really reviving Macaulay. It's reviving partly Macaulay's argument that if you extended copyright law, that would have terrible effects because people wouldn't have any respect for it. And Lippmann is talking about the question of why people violate laws. And it's not clear to me if she's right or not. I was going to get your opinion on some of that. So what are some of the reasons that Lippmann thinks perfectly ordinary people violate laws? Drive faster than the speed limit, say. Anybody?
They don't believe in certain law. They don't believe it should be in place.
Should be is one possibility. There's one possible reason is you disapprove of the law. A different reason, which I think she's a little unclear of, is you don't really think it's there. And it wasn't clear to me whether she literally means you don't know it's there. Or whether you say, well, yes, it's in paper, but... And I was thinking actually of the example of speed limits. Because as an American driver, what do you believe the real law is? You see a sign that says 65 mile an hour speed limit. What does that mean?
75.
What? What was your... I heard their answer. What was your answer? You're being generous.
But I won't get caught.
You're being generous. Oh, you mean you go down 15 miles?
No,
oh, that's right. You're being generous. I would have said that I interpret it as 75. That is, that I would have said that the rough rule of thumb in the U.S. is that if you're driving less than 10 miles over the speed limit, you won't get caught. And what I was told by a police woman on one occasion when I got a ticket, because I was not paying attention, I was driving more than that, is that the right rule is drive at the same speed as everybody else. And if they're all going 80 in a 65 mile an hour zone, you're pretty safe, which is probably pretty good advice on the whole. But that's an example. And so similarly, I think there have been various points at which copyright law, at which parts of copyright law, people felt the same way. Suppose you were told that in fact 65 mile an hour means if you drive 67 they'll put you in jail for a day. Every time they catch you.
Oh, every time they catch you.
Yeah, and they will sometimes catch you. This is not an imaginary case, by the way. This is New Zealand. I don't know what the exact terms are, but I was told when I was visiting New Zealand and renting a car that in New Zealand they take speed limits seriously and they put people in jail for violating them. All right. And I think in jail for, you know, a day or a week or something, but enough to be a serious inconvenience not to wreck your life. And I'm sure New Zealand has nice jails. They're a pretty civilized country as far as I can tell, but I still had other things I wanted to do that week. So in that world, it seems to me you would look rather differently at speed limits, and you would, in fact, treat them seriously. So it seems we've got several different theories about why people might ignore laws. And one of them is that they either don't know it's there or believe that it's there but not enforced, or is enforced in some looser fashion. She says because it doesn't stick in their head, that I'm not quite sure what that means, but I guess she means because they don't know it's there, they've forgotten it or something. And then the third one, which I think was what the first answer was suggesting, is because they don't regard the fact that the law is a good reason. That is, they disagree with the law. So I was curious as to your view on the subject. So let me take... Let me take a number of the different examples that she's offering. One of the things she was describing, and I wasn't sure I knew of any examples, but maybe you do, is people who say, well, yes, it's a bad law, but it's good symbolism, and therefore you should obey it. And the example that she mentioned, I think, was drug laws, where even people who say, well, the drug laws really don't work, still say that it symbolizes the fact we're against it. And I think I've seen that argument made about things like prostitution, that even people who recognize that laws against prostitution don't actually have good effects say, but if you legalized it, you would be endorsing the idea that sex is the sort of thing that's supposed to be sold. I think that's wrong. I mean, I think if you look at societies where it's legal, people do not regard that as the optimal form of sex. They regard that as what you do when you can't find anything better, so to speak. But nonetheless, that's an argument. So I'm curious, can any of you think of laws which fit that category for you? Of a law where you would say, I believe the effect of the law is not good, but I support it because it sends the right message. Nobody at all. How about age of consent laws? That's one which strikes me as a little bizarre about our society. There are a fair number of states, including this one, in which the age at which having sex with somebody is a felony is lower than the median age for loss of virginity. That is to say, in which if you have sex with somebody at an age in which the odds are at least 50% that the random person of that age will have had sex, you are committing a felony. Pretty clearly, it is not preventing people who are younger than 18 from having sex, because if it were, we wouldn't have an age of loss of virginity of 70. I don't really know what the age is for California, but the U.S. figure is about 17, I think. And is it still a good law? Does it still symbolize the fact that kids shouldn't be doing it or not? No comments. Yeah?
Well, I don't think it's really that kids shouldn't be having sex. I mean, I grew up in Washington, our statutory rape laws are slightly different. So it's actually the age of the younger person versus the age of the older person.
Yes.
And I think it's more about manipulation of children sexually than it is about whether or not a child can understand what they're doing. I mean, I think that if it's just a hard line of someone over 18, someone younger 18, that's statutory, or if it's anyone under 18, I think that law, it just seems...
But you're not really satisfied with my requirement, because you're saying you approve of the effect of the version of the law that Washington had, I think, or do you?
I do approve of the version.
Of the effect as well as the symbolism.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to look for things where one doesn't approve of the effect but does approve of the symbolism.
Well, see, in the instance with, I believe California's laws are written that even if two people are under 18 and they have sex with each other consensually,
they are both committing a crime.
But
then that's not an example either. The laws vary state by state.
Yeah.
And part of what I find bizarre, partly because I've been looking at other legal systems, is how high the ages are, right? I mean, age of adulthood for a woman in rabbinic law is 12 and a half. As far as I can tell, in medieval law, it was something like 13 for a woman and 14 for a man. So that one of the odd things about our society is the attempt to maintain a gap of years between physical maturity and actual sexual activity, which... not clear how well it works, but at least our society claims to believe in it. But can you think of other examples? It doesn't have to be sex. Sex is just one. Yo.
I know some people that think that capital punishment is a gigantic waste of money, and yet still they
are in favor of it.
They're in favor of it just because they just feel like it's just right.
Yeah, but that's coming closer, I think. I hadn't thought of that example, but it's a good example. If somebody says, look, the right moral principle is that if you kill somebody, you ought to hang. And it happens that it's because we are very unwilling to risk hanging the wrong person, that it's hard to implement it, and in practice we don't hang very many people who kill people, and trying to do it costs a fortune. And so I could imagine somebody who said that and yet said it symbolically right. You know, that wouldn't be a bad example. I wonder if you could get the same thing for some people for abortion. If you could have people who would say, well, yes, the laws against abortion don't work very well, it's too hard to prevent it, but we don't want to take the position that we legally endorse murder. And if you think abortion is murder, that's what it is. So maybe that might not be a bad one. You might get the same thing for euthanasia, for that matter, would be another one. So, yeah, I think it's hard to think of such examples, but I'm not sure that they don't exist. Let me now take the one that's immediately relevant to most of us. How many people here feel morally bound not to pirate music? All right? That's all right. You don't have to be embarrassed about it.
I'm the only one.
Yeah. Yes. No, I think I would agree. As I think I mentioned last time, I make an exception in those cases where I believe that I'm violating copyright law in a way that the copyright holder would approve of. But as a general rule, I feel morally bound not to pirate software, which is more relevant to me than music most of the time. Anything else? Let's think for a moment of people who feel morally bound to obey. Can you think of any law that it would be useful to violate, that you don't violate, and that you don't think there's any noticeable chance you're being punished for violating? Have any case where the moral constraint, rather than the legal constraint or the fact you don't want to do it? Can you think of examples? Yes.
Maybe if you hit somebody's car and no one sees it happen.
Right.
Do you leave a note?
Good example. That's right. And the answer is you do.
Yes. You
right.
Do, 'cause it's
right. It's morally right.
Morally right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good one, actually. Because you're always tempted not to, of course, in that case. So for all of the people who do not feel morally bound not to pirate programs, is that because you think it's a bad law? Or is it because I'm curious, sort of. Yeah, let's go back. Let me go back and ask the more general statement. Because, see, I don't believe in law. The reason I feel obliged not to do it just seems to me it's unfair to the creators. So let's ask a different question. Is the fact that something is the law, independent of its moral its independent moral status and enforcement, itself a reason to obey it? All right, Congress passes a law. Is the fact that Congress has made it the law an independent reason to obey that law?
Are you talking about piracy right now?
Anything. General proposition. Drinking laws, right? That's actually a pretty good one, because I suspect that most people in this room have probably drunk alcohol illegally at some point, unless you don't like alcohol at all, because that's a very poorly enforced law. So if the minimum age of drinking is raised from 18 to 21, do you regard that as having any effect at all, either on your willingness to drink if you're between those ages or on your willingness to provide alcohol to someone else, assuming you won't get caught? Yeah?
I think from a Christian perspective is that if the law is the law, then you should follow the law. So I think some people have a moral obligation to follow that.
Believe they have a moral obligation, yeah.
At least some people do.
Well, but I wouldn't have associated it mostly with Christianity, though that's one basis. I would have said that the secular religion of our society is democracy, and that a lot of people would at least say, I'm not sure they'd act that way, but they would say that it's the will of the people and you're obliged to obey it. Now, how many of them actually act that way, I'm not sure. And that's sort of where I part company with the secular religion, because I've never seen any good reason why democracy has any more moral status than any other form of government, as far as I can tell. You know, it may be a sensitive, it's certainly arguable that of the ways of running a government, it might work better than the alternatives. But I can't see that somehow, if you just take a pure democracy, that the fact that 51% of the people are for something somehow makes it morally binding when 49% don't. And yet that's sort of implicit in the idea. And there are various arguments for, you know, that could be a long argument. If people are really curious, there's a book by Michael Humer called The Problem of Political Authority, which is, the first half of which is running through different philosophers' arguments for why governments have a right to do things that other people wouldn't have a right to do, basically, to tax you or to impose restrictions and so forth. And it's an interesting book. So that's a good one. Is there anybody in this room who at any point in his life would have either refrained from drinking or refrained from offering a drink to somebody solely because it was illegal? Two of us. All right. Three. Four of us. All right. Five of us. Six. I made it at any point of my life, because I wouldn't anymore. But at one point, at least, it was my view. So if we're thinking that one of the constraints of laws is that people have to obey them for them to have very much effect, if you believe that everyone thinks if it's the law, I'll obey it, that gives you much less constraint on what laws you can pass than at the other extreme where if you say you could say the pure version, the other direction, would be law has no moral effect at all. What's the point of passing laws if people are going to not give drinks to minors or not pirate private songs because they think it's wrong, and we don't need a law to make it. And then it seems to me there's an intermediate step. And the intermediate step says, well, there is a real moral obligation here, but there are also fuzzy lines. So that I'm willing to say that my default rule is that I won't pirate your book if it's within copyright, and I will pirate it if it's outside of copyright. Although if you really complain to me about your outside of copyright book, maybe I would be persuaded not to pirate it. So that there's a sense in which, in a certain odd way, you could say that the law is defining a language. If you say, when I copyright, back when you had copyright notices, when I copyright it, I'm making a specific claim, and what that claim is, the state. You think of a lot of cases in which a legal system can set a default rule, which has an effect, and would have an effect even if you didn't think of the legal system as morally binding, because you say that rule says what it is you have agreed to. All right, if you think about an employment contract, all right, suppose the default rule is employment at will. In that case, I don't feel entitled to complain when they fire me. If the default rule is you can only be fired for cause, even if I'm a complete believer in freedom of contract, I would say, well, if that wasn't your intent, when you hired me, you should have asked me to sign a waiver saying that you didn't have to cause. And if you didn't, now you can only fire me for cause. So in that sense, the law could have an effect even without having any moral significance in an odd kind of way, just because it tells what people what the words they're using mean. Yep?
I think with also with digital music and piracy, I think a lot of people don't think that they're really harming anyone. Especially when it's, when you have people who seem to be making a lot of money off of music. If it's, like a small independent group or somebody you know, I think it might be different. But I think if you don't know that, people sort of think there is no harm.
But part of the problem with that argument is that people are very willing to use it in a lot of other contexts. Yeah. This goes back to the point that I think Hume or Locke made, that everybody is a biased judge in his own interest. So think about a shoplifter. All right, a shoplifter can also make that argument. The shoplifter can say, well, it's just hurting this big company. They won't even notice. And it's sort of easy to think of companies as not people because they aren't people and forget that somewhere there are human beings in that chain. There are stockholders or employees or whoever is bearing the cost that you're imposing. So, no, I think you're right, but in a way that really goes back to a version of law itself has no moral significance, because you're saying what's morally wrong is hurting people. That's sort of a utilitarian kind of approach to right and wrong. This doesn't hurt people, so therefore why shouldn't I feel free to do it? And I think that is an element. All right. Enough interesting stuff at this point so that I'm not going to cover anything like all of my outline, but let's go on to the question of the First Amendment in copyright. That to what extent is there a potential conflict between, since the First Amendment is an amendment and therefore after the body of the law, should we say that when the First Amendment was passed, the copyright part of the copyright clause was just repealed? Doesn't copyright statute infringe on the freedom of speech? I am not allowed to read aloud your book on the air. That's freedom of speech, surely. Yes? No? Anybody? How about defamation law? Is all defamation law unconstitutional? Nobody? Yes? Maybe? That, I think, was Justice Black's opinion, as I understand it, that he thought the defamation law was unconstitutional. I believe. I think that's right. But not a very... not a very popular. Now you can argue, I think some of the readings do argue, that what saves it is the idea expression distinction. That freedom of speech, in effect, says I can say anything, but I can't necessarily say it in any words. And certainly there are other contexts in which things like fighting words and obscenity, where you're saying, yes, I am entitled to say the content of anything, but the choice of words is sometimes restricted. There's a neat bit in one of Robert Heinlein's science fiction novels, in which you've got some people who are organizing a revolution against an oppressive theocracy in future America. And one of them is, they're both, I think, ex-members of the government's military, but one of them is a psychological warfare officer, and his friend, is who is rather naive, is not. And the psychological warfare officer is saying that it what matters is not just what you say, but how you say it. And his friend says, well, you know, that may be true to sort of uneducated peasants, but to sophisticated people like you and me, the important thing is, his friend then says something, and you were never told what it is. And the bystanders have to pull the guy off his friend who he's violently attacking as a result. And the man says, all I said was that you were the legitimate offspring of a legal marriage. And you get to imagine what words he said that in. So that's a possibility. But part of the problem is that the idea expression distinction is really a matter of degree, not of kind. Is Superman an expression or an idea? And that court case decided that Superman was an expression, that if you had another superhero with a different name but roughly the same characteristics, you were really pirating it. Let me go on to a different one of these, because I've got a bunch of things I just wanted to touch because they were interesting, and I'll let you think about them. You've got the rest of, till next class at least, to think about it if you feel like it. Nimmer argues that the fact that the Mile photos are really important makes them not protectable. Does that make any sense? What's wrong with that argument? Anybody? What's the consequence? Suppose we say Mile photos are not covered by copyright. People know what Mile photos are? Mile was a massacre in Vietnam done by American troops. And there may have been other such massacres, but that was the one that became public, was a big scandal. I think one officer ended up spending a year or 2 years in prison for his role in murdering 50 people or whatever was involved, quite a large number of people. And part of the reason was that somehow somebody had gotten some photographs of the carnage and that got publicized. So it certainly, I think it's perfectly reasonable to say it was very important that those photographs go out. But the question is, does holding that such photographs are not protectable make them more or less likely to actually show up in newspapers? You're the photographer. Are you more likely to risk getting shot by people if you can make money or if you can't? That is, all of this is ignoring, in a sense, the problem which underlies all intellectual property, namely the tension between the incentive to create and the incentive to distribute. And that the making it unprotectable reduces the incentive of photographers to go into dangerous places and take important photographs. At the same time that once the photographs are there and have been published once, it means you can distribute them more easily. On the other hand, if you're going to go, it's not like you can make him publish them in the first place if they're not protectable. And if he wants to publish them, he'll want it even more if he can get license fees for doing it, because they're obviously very newsworthy. Right. Anyway, I think we're done with today. I've got lots more things we could talk about. Sometimes I run out, and sometimes I end up finding that I've got more interesting things to talk about because interesting things come up. See you next week.